Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Rattlesnakes that inhabit the inner city and mold that kills grasshoppers are two topics of research for grad students at the University of Lethbridge. Juanita Andrus and Susan Ants discuss the importance of their findings to our understanding of the environment. And with $5.5 million in funding, ICOR has launched a new chair and a lab in intelligent RF radio technology. Dr. Fidel Ganucci talks about his work, which could give us a new ICT buddy, making cell phones and other handheld devices obsolete. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The venomous bite of the rattlesnake is enough to stop any hardened cowboy in his tracks. At least, that's the scenario for many a Western movie. So, how come Juanita Andrus isn't scared of rattlesnakes? Juanita is a graduate student in environmental science at the University of Lethbridge. She's studying the impact of urban development on rattlesnakes. And it appears the word squeamish just isn't in her vocabulary.
No, I'm not too bad, actually. I grew up in a very small town, Bindloss, Alberta, and it's a rural community that's completely saturated with all sorts of different species of snakes. And so I kind of grew up with them being in my backyard and having to be careful everywhere I went. So I'm pretty used to them.
The research that you're doing for your graduate work is dealing with rattlesnakes. What can you tell me about rattlesnakes?
Well, rattlesnakes are extremely interesting species because they're a very misunderstood species. They're not a very aggressive animal, but of course people have a lot of fear for them because they do have venom and they can potentially cause you a great deal of discomfort and sickness. However, you know, I work with rattlesnakes all summer long, and I've handled close to 70 snakes, and I've been struck at once, and it was completely because I walked up to the snake and scared him. It was not a matter of him trying to hurt me. I scared him, he scared me, sort of thing. So,
well, what are they like? Do they stick to certain areas? Do they travel around a lot?
Well, there's a lot of variation in it. Out of the studies that I've read, it seems that usually they travel in long, single direction movements, and that's thought to be in correlation with the sun. But in my particular population, because of the degree of habitat fragmentation that I'm dealing with, I'm finding that my snakes move in short, meandering movement patterns in between available habitat patches. So there is some variation. But in general, there's a high degree of den fidelity where they'll return to the same wintering hibernaculum over and over every year for their entire life.
Now, do those hibernaculum happen to be right in the middle of Lethbridge?
Yeah, that's exactly why I'm studying here in Lethbridge. We have a number of hibernaculum, all in areas that are of high recreational use for humans. And so there's quite a bit of conflict between the humans using and needing the facilities and the snakes trying to make their home in them. So it's difficult.
What is the question that you're addressing then?
Basically, I'm looking at how the habitat fragmentation is affecting the rattlesnake's ability to stay in Lethbridge on a long-term basis. So for us to be able to help them maintain numbers and populations that are viable for the future.
How many snakes are you dealing with?
Well, initially it was estimated that there were between 30 and 50 snakes in the Lethbridge population, but I have personally implanted snakes with microchips to the number of 45. In addition to that, we found another 19 that we weren't able to process, and there's at least another 18 neonates or baby snakes that I've come across this year alone. So I think we're up in the region of probably 60 adults and, you know, around 20 to 30 youth.
Now, how do you implant
these microchips?
So basically what I do is I have a hollow needle, and the microchip just slips into the hollow needle, and I disinfect the area on the rattlesnake skin and insert the needle just below the skin, so that it's not in its body cavity. It's just below the skin so that it is a permanent thing, but I'm able to read it easily with a machine that's designed to read the number that it's given.
But you have to catch them first, don't you?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, how we handle them is we have professionally designed snake tongs. And so they're basically, if you can imagine like a big hot dog grabber, if you know what I'm talking about, they're like that, only they're designed and curved so that they will not cause any harm to the snake at all. They put equal amount of pressure over the snake. And so we basically take the snake and put it in a 5-gallon bucket, and then we weigh it, and using two people, we'll have one restrain the snake with a snake restraint device that's been designed to do that, and the other person take the measurements, do the implantation of the microchip, and weighing that sort of information.
So do you have to go running across the field after the snake with these tongs in your hand to catch them?
They don't really move that fast. Basically what a snake initially does when you come across it is it tries to hide, because it's of course got great camouflage, so it uses that to its advantage, and so it'll stay very still, and of course that's when we're able to snag it. But if it is near a hole, then it becomes more difficult, because their instinct is to instantly go down into the hole, so you have to be pretty quick. But I'm also using with some snakes, I'm implanting them with transmitters that allow me to follow them day after day and see what they're up to. So in that manner, I don't have to keep re-catching them. I'm able to gather information without coming near them or disturbing them.
How are these transmitters put into the snakes?
Actually, those are implanted by a veterinarian. We have a great vet here who's been helping us out with the project. And he basically anesthetizes the snake, puts the transmitter into the body cavity and attaches it to the rib, and then he sews the snake back up. And after monitoring it for a little while and applying some pain medication, the snake's pretty much good to go after a few hours, 24 hours about.
Now, you're looking at fragmentation of the habitat for the snakes. What are you finding out?
Well, I found out a lot of interesting things. For one thing, I found a number of hibernacula that we didn't know presently existed or hadn't confirmed that it was actually used by more than one snake or in key times of when a hibernacula is needed. So that is a big discovery in itself. Also, we've been able to assure that certain parks and areas that the rattlesnakes are only found in Lethbridge are actually connected with available grasslands, so that the snakes aren't having to cross roads necessarily to be able to access different metapopulations and be able to mate with different groups, which is quite a relief, actually, because maybe the degree of fragmentation isn't too much for them to overcome, and that would mean that they would be able to sustain themselves over the long term.
There's an awful lot of development going on in Lethbridge now, both in housing and commercial development. What does that mean for the snakes?
That's mainly the concern with the snakes being an inner city population. Often, because not every hibernaculum is known, developments could occur right over a hibernaculum or destroy a hibernaculum, and the developer would never know what they had done, right? In addition to that, the different buildings and the roads that we construct increase the mortality rates of the snakes, because they'll be crossing those roads. They'll be going through residential areas and meeting up with pets and things like that that can hurt them. So it's definitely a concern that has to be addressed.
Do you have any ideas for residents?
For residents, basically, if you come across a snake, the most important thing to do is to remain calm. They're not going to be attacking you. It's really one of those things that it's only if they're extremely frightened that they'll lash out. So if you just remain calm, and if you have someone in your area that does snake removal, such as myself or Reg Ernst, who's in Lethbridge, you can get them to come and remove the snakes and basically just remember that they're not out to get you. They're not monsters. They're really just trying to get by.
Rattlesnakes, though, they're endangered in Alberta, aren't they?
Yeah, they're an at-risk species in Alberta, which means that they're protected by the Alberta Wildlife Act, and so is their hibernaculum. So any willful destruction of them or their hibernaculums can actually result in legal prosecution for you. So it's one of those things that, you know, when we're doing developments, we don't want to disturb the hibernaculums because not only are they important to the snakes, but it's illegal too. So there's many different factors.
You happen to have a rattlesnake rattle here. Could you shake that for me?
Absolutely.
How does it do that?
Basically, the segments of the rattle are kind of disjointed, and so the different segments will move up and down, and it's quite flexible. And as the segments hit each other, it produces the rattlesnake sound. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Juanita Andres, a graduate student in environmental science at the University of Lethbridge. Her research on the ecology and conservation of prairie rattlesnakes is being done in collaboration with the City of Lethbridge and the Fish and Wildlife Division of Alberta Sustainable Resource Development. Dr. Dan Johnson is one of Canada's foremost experts on grasshoppers, and several of his graduate students at the University of Lethbridge are looking for more natural means to control outbreaks of these insects. One is Susan Entz. Her master's work has focused on a fungus used in other parts of the world, and as a result of her research, she's developed a new test to detect it.
This fungus falls into the genus Metarhizium, and it has been commercialized globally for biological control of grasshoppers in Australia and Africa.
Where was this fungus originally discovered?
Oh, that's a good question, because this genus is quite complex. It consists of a wide variety of what you might call siblings, and most of them have specific hosts. So when you talk about where it originated, well, we've got so many different varieties within this genus, it's quite difficult to determine.
How does it actually work on the grasshoppers?
Well, the way it infects grasshoppers is that a spore will land on the grasshopper cuticle, and it will penetrate the cuticle by a combination of enzymatic and mechanical means once it's within the grasshopper, and providing it overcomes the grasshopper's host defenses, it will then replicate itself within the grasshopper. Eventually, the grasshopper will die, and the fungus will produce hyphae, which then penetrate the grasshopper, and it re-enters the environment where it produces more spores, and the whole cycle begins again.
So for your research, then, what you've been looking at is whether or not we can use this in Canada?
Yes, what we wanted to do was devise a molecular means of tracing this fungus in the environment, and that was the primary research focus of my thesis.
So what did you do?
I basically devised a molecular assay that would specifically detect the fungus in question.
And how does that work?
It recognizes a certain nucleotide sequence within the genome of the fungus. And that nucleotide sequence is specific to that fungus. So if we find it, we can be relatively assured that it does belong to that particular organism.
So how do you actually test for that?
Well, what we do is we extract the DNA either from the fungus itself in pure culture or from infected grasshoppers that have been exposed to that particular fungus. And once the DNA is extracted, we run it through a test known as a polymerase chain reaction assay, which is also known as PCR. It's very common. And through a series of amplifications of the specific sequence in question, we end up with a visible product when we analyze it later.
Is there any indication at this point that the introduction of this fungus would cause any environmental problems here in Canada?
Probably not, because extensive safety testing has been conducted on this organism. We have looked at the impact on non-target organisms. For example, Dan and his colleagues have determined that application of this fungus is safe to ringneck pheasants in Canada, but it has also been shown to be safe to aquatic organisms and other insects that interact with grasshoppers in the natural ecosystem.
This particular fungus is coming from outside the country, but did you find, do we have anything like it that's here naturally?
Well, in a soil survey I conducted after we developed the assay, we did find a few related isolates of Metarhizium that were very similar to the commercial isolate we were thinking of using. And in later bioassays, we did find that we had one isolate that showed a degree of infection in grasshoppers that was comparable to the commercial isolate.
So is that something that we could look at commercializing here?
It is a possibility, but we have a lot more work to do. For example, because this isolate was obtained from soil, we really don't know what the host target or range is, so that would have to be determined prior to any application of this fungus.
What's the next step now that you've done the assay? What happens now?
Well, what happens now is that we're trying to find an industry partner who is interested in collaborating with us in terms of more work to evaluate how safe our native fungus would be and what its potential impact would be on non-target organisms.
And as far as the fungus that's already been commercialized, is it something that we'll see being used in Canada soon, or is there still more work to be done on that one?
Well, we probably won't see it soon because it is considered an exotic organism. So there's certainly some degree of concern over the introduction of exotics for biological control.
It seems like there's an awful lot of research that's going on in this whole area of biological control. What else is happening?
In terms of molecular monitoring, it's still very early in the science in this area. So there will, of course, be more research done, but we hope to eventually, apply it.
So why should we go the biological route? Why not just nuke these things with all the chemicals that we have out there already?
Well, for one thing, chemicals are not target-specific. They tend to act upon a lot of non-target organisms. There are also environmental and health concerns involved with the use of chemical pesticides.
So has your work been published?
Yes, it has. It's titled Development of a PCR-Based Diagnostic Assay for the Specific Detection of the Entomopathogenic Fungus Metarhizium anisopliae variety acridum, and it's been published in the journal Mycological Research. And you can get a copy by contacting Dan Johnson at dan.johnson@uleth.ca.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Thank you.
That was Susan Ants, a master's student in environmental science at the University of Lethbridge. Her supervisor is Dr. Dan Johnson. He holds a Canada Research Chair in Sustainable Grassland Ecosystems. While the world goes crazy over wireless, there are still some critical technical problems to be solved. ICOR, the Alberta Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, believes it could contribute to a major breakthrough in the field of radio frequency, and that's through the establishment of a new ICOR research chair in intelligent RF radio technology. With $5.5 million in funding, ICOR has attracted Dr. Fidel Ganucci, a world leader in radio technology. He is moving from Montreal to the University of Calgary to do this research. At the recent launch of this new chair and the iRadio Lab, I spoke first with Dr. Randy Gable, ICOR's president and CEO.
So far, ICOR's plans have included trying to accelerate areas where Alberta had a chance in the world of developing some critical mass. This complements other things that are going on, mostly in the design of devices in support of wireless communication. So radio frequency communications and being efficient with respect to electronic devices at the boundary between analog and digital devices is where this fits.
Well, radio seems so old hat.
Well, when people think of radio, they think of those things that you carried around, the first transistor radios in the 60s. I think that radio these days is even more important because radio encompasses all radio frequency transmission communication, so we're even more reliant on wireless communications, which you couldn't tell by looking at a lab full of wires, but in fact, modern radio is making the most efficient use of bandwidth through all spectrums, all frequencies.
When you were introducing the new research chair, you looked around the room and you acknowledged what you're calling the ICOR Academy. How big is the ICOR Academy now?
Right now, the ICOR Academy is 23 awards with 22 people. One person currently holds two ICOR awards, both professorship and industrial research chair. So that's the size of the people who have been appointed. But of course, the size is much bigger because there are graduate students, faculty in support of ICOR awards, the ICOR team, the ICOR secretariat, the whole thing is well over 600 people now.
How did you manage to attract Dr. Gannucci from the University of Montreal?
I wish I could take any credit for it, but I think ICOR's role has largely been glue and stickiness in the process of attracting people. So when someone, like in this case, I think Josh Leon at ECE, had this idea that there was a gap in the research capacity in ECE here, he identified the best person he could find on the planet. That happened to be Fidel Gannucci, and he asked for support to try to recruit him to Alberta. That's where ICOR participated. And it's where, with the help of guys like the dean and the chair and all of the other people at the University of Calgary, you're able to construct a landing spot to attract somebody like that here.
Thank you very much, Randy.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Randy Gable, president and CEO of ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence. Dr. Fidel Gannucci is the newly appointed ICOR professor and Canada Research Chair in Intelligent RF Radio Technology at the University of Calgary. He will head the new iRadio Lab, the first of its kind in Canada to address some of the global problems in this field.
My background is in radio frequency and microwave engineering. So I expand this area by adding more discipline or making some work related to more discipline like digital signal processing communication system. So the integration of these disciplines led to this intelligent RF radio technology area, which I am now working on and at the University of Calgary.
Well, you talked about problems that we have with our cell phones and iPods and personal computers with the batteries running down or trying to do better communications. How is it that the high-frequency radio, how does that fit into our everyday applications of these technologies?
Yeah, any communication terminal, whether cell phone or wireless PC or satellite communication, involve radio frequency signals. So the problem is to how to make this communication terminal more efficient in terms of energy, so consume less power, so the battery lasts longer, and at the same time how to make them faster, in the sense that how we can download or upload information or see, let's say, an example is how we can see live video in your cell phones, things like that. So this is make the devices faster. And the last point also is to make the device universal, so the same device can be used anywhere in the world, because in different part of the world, the standards are not the same. So if you move from Europe to North America, the standards are different, so you need to change your terminals or your telephone or your communication. So my goal is to contribute to design one terminal that I can call ICT body. So it means that really it becomes part of you. You can go anywhere and you have your own communication and information terminals.
How are you going to do that?
This is the ultimate goal. If I, I believe that I can contribute in different aspects and to reach this level of sophistication. I am also aware that this kind of devices needs a lot of effort and a lot of resources, but I believe I will contribute in radio frequency aspect related to this device.
What are the challenges at this point?
I think the main challenge is now facing all these communication devices is to make them more efficient. We don't want to recharge our batteries. We want something that lasts for a month without charging. So if we have a cell phone or have a PC or we have anything that does not need any charge or need a little bit of power, this is make it much more attractive for companies and for even for daily use. The second thing is to make them smaller when the consumption goes down, so the battery are smaller, so you can make smaller device.
Could you give me an example?
Example, if you look to the state of the art of terminals, communication terminal now, they are made with three parts. The first part is what we call the RF front end. It's the dummy part. The second part is more the digital signal processing part. It's more digital. It's a small computer within the terminal itself. And the third part is the interface between these two, the RF part and digital signal processing. So, and conventionally, these parts, the different parts are designed separately without any interaction between. The way we're approaching this problem is to couple this, basically the DSP part to the RF part, such that implement kind of intelligence within the radio itself. So the radio knows, let's say, if you are in Europe, they will sense, and though now the standard is different, they will configure itself, and so such that you can use it. So it's kind of self-reconfigurability or smart, make it smart or make it more intelligent. So the main contribution is to design, to look to the problem not only from system-level point of view or device point of view, is to look to the problem from different angle and try to come up with optimal solution.
Well, I'm looking forward to the My ICT Buddy. When do you think we might see that?
I think we're not so far. Maybe 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. I think 10 years. I think maybe 10 years. It's a reasonable, target.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. My pleasure.
That was Dr. Fidel Ghannouchi, the new ICOR professor and Canada Research Chair in Intelligent RF Radio Technology at the University of Calgary. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Research Council, Calgary Technologies Inc., Alberta Innovation and Science, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Ingenuity, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crutcher.